Today's guest is business growth expert Stephen S. Little. You're listening to the Eagles Talent Connection Podcast. You are listening to the Eagles Talent Connection Podcast. Eagles Talent Connection is a speakers and entertainment bureau. For more information on how Eagles Talent Connection can help bring the best talent into your next event, contact us at 1-800-345-5607 or visit us online at www.eaglestalent.com. Of the Eagles Talent Connection podcast. My name is Sheldon Sinek. Today's subject is business growth. And what better person to talk about this than Stephen S. Little? Stephen is a professional speaker and also the author of the best-selling books, The 7 Irrefutable Rules of Small Business Growth and The Milkshake Moment, Overcoming Stupid Systems, Pointless Policies, and Muddled Management to Realize Real Growth. Stephen S. Little, welcome to the Eagles Talent Connection podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Stephen S. Little has a new book coming out in June titled Duck and Recover, The Embattled Business Owner's Guide to Survival and Growth. So business growth, that to me is a word synonymous with you as both a speaker and an author. When listening to you or reading your work, you're very much, you seem a real advocate for business growth, whether a large company that is trying to rediscover its direction or a mom and pop shop that is trying to stay ahead of the curve. When did you recognize that you had a real ability to help companies understand the foundations of growth and opportunity? And what led you to all this?
Well, it probably helps to know that I was president of three fast growth companies over about a 12-year period. So, first I was a practitioner. Mm-hmm. And then at some point I discovered that I liked talking about business growth more than I liked actually doing it. And if you have any success at all in your industry, your community, you're asked to speak on it. And most people avoid it. You know, they don't want to do that. And I discovered that I both enjoyed it and the people assembled seemed to enjoy it. So I got asked more and more, and at some point it flipped over to where I was speaking more than I was actually running companies. And I found that there were what I like to call universal truths about growth. Mm-hmm. There are things that organizations do differently that grow than the organizations that don't grow. Mm-hmm. And while it's true to say some organizations don't want to grow, mm-hmm. they're pretty few and far between. I rarely meet an organization whose mission statement doesn't have something to do with getting bigger and better, and mm-hmm. they put those as synonymous. There's absolutely nothing wrong with not wanting to grow. Mm-hmm. I just find that most organizations, whether it profit, nonprofit, publicly held, privately held, faith-based, Cub Scout troop, most organizations want to grow, and so that has certainly become my umbrella word. And what's happened now is, of course, that the world has changed mm-hmm. quite significantly, and so my first two books were written about growth and happened to fall in good times. Mm-hmm. As we reach these more challenging times, it was imperative in my mind that I put out a book that really talked about that growth can still be the goal even when it appears as if it's a tougher goal. And mm-hmm. That's really what the new book's about.
We live in a society that loves a checklist to be told what you need, and you need XYZ in order to achieve success. In a 2005 article in the American Staffing Association, you write, there is no single strategy for achieving business growth. As much as we would like to find it, the guaranteed 17-point checklist that leads to business growth simply doesn't exist. So that being said, you do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that there are consistent areas where companies grow and should concentrate their efforts? And these kind of times, where should they put their efforts?
First of all, you've done a good job of giving a good synopsis of what I believe, which is, just to paraphrase, mm-hmm. that it isn't so much what I tell people what to do. I help them see the places where they should look to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There are specific areas in which organizations that grow do put the most time, money, and effort, mm-hmm. and where the leadership concentrates their resources in order to achieve sustainable, profitable growth. And nothing has changed about that just because the economy has suddenly turned for the worse. And so getting back to those core areas mm-hmm. that people really need to look at has not changed, but perhaps what it is we do within those areas has changed to an extent. While there are no 17-point checklists, there are areas you should concentrate. And so your question, I think, is well, where would one look to concentrate now?
Right.
And the first area that I would advise people to look is to really closely examine their most closely held beliefs about what it is that their business is in business to do. What is the true purpose? Because right now, I run into an awful lot of businesses that are trying to serve a mission, trying to serve a purpose that perhaps has passed them by now, that mm-hmm. the world has changed pretty fundamentally in the last, say, 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and they have not rethought the purpose of that business, what gets them out of bed. Wealth accumulation is not a sense of purpose. More money is not what gets you out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
Right now is a good time to say, what does get me out of bed? Because purpose always precedes profits,
mm-hmm.
always. And finding that true sense of purpose, you know, I'll be the first to admit that sounds awfully broad,
mm-hmm.
but I also would say that specificity isn't what I'm calling for here. Just a clear direction in your own mind of why your business exists,
mm-hmm.
who does it uniquely serve, and what really gets you excited. People talk about trying to identify their passions, and I get that to an extent,
mm-hmm.
but you know, I have a lot of friends that like to drink. I'm not sure that means they should own a bar. You know?
Right.
And so understanding what it is that truly gives purpose and meaning to our lives through our business, getting clearer on that is a great place to start, especially when times are challenging like they are. Another thing that I have been talking about an awful lot lately is the idea that there is conventional wisdoms out there
mm-hmm.
regarding how we should behave in a downturn.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of advice right now for the both the entrepreneur and the entrepreneurial thinking leader,
mm-hmm.
there's an awful lot of advice out there. And for so many, this is the first time they've been through a downturn in a leadership position, and they are more apt to perhaps seek outside advice. My concern is that this advice tends to be overgeneralized. You know, you and I talked before we started taping, and I explained that Mark Twain is one of my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Twain, I think, said it best. He said, all generalizations are false, mm-hmm. including this one. And that is what I see right now.
Right.
An awful lot of generalizations that might apply to the majority of companies but may not apply to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so my new book takes on some of that conventional thinking and tries to put it on its head and say, let's really look at it. Let's reexamine this conventional thinking, because it'd be so easy if I could say reject all conventional thinking, but life just isn't that simple.
Okay.
So let me give you two examples, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first is conventional thinking to say you should get even closer to your financial information in a time like this,
mm-hmm.
when cash flow is tighter, when margins for error perhaps is less than ever before,
right.
that one should be very driven by their P&L statement and their cash flow projections. I couldn't agree more. It's both conventional thinking, and it's wise, it's common sense, and we all should get much closer to our financial data perhaps than we ever have before.
Hmm.
If you don't know how to keep score in business, you have a heck of a lot less likelihood of winning. So
right.
I agree with that. One that I challenge on a regular basis is the idea that we should concentrate solely on shoring up our existing customers.
Hmm.
And not look for new business,
mm-hmm.
Because we have all been taught, of course, that it costs 5 times more to get a new customer than it costs to keep an existing customer.
Mm-hmm.
I've been saying that for about 6 months, and I wait on stage, and I'll wait now. Everyone accepts it as truth because we've heard it so often,
right.
And I completely reject it. I say it's false. If it's true for you, it's only anecdotal, or it's a mere coincidence. There is no standard rule of what it should cost to get a new customer.
Mm-hmm.
you can get very efficient in times like this, customer acquisition and retention.
Mm-hmm. And that tends to hold people back, too, by believing in this.
It's a fallacy. Yeah. I call it the 5-to-1 fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have heard 7-to-1, some people have heard 5-to-1, mostly 5-to-1 is what we hear. In some industries, it's 20-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
In some industries I've been in, it's a 1-to-1 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these things that you can find it in peer-reviewed journals. You can find it listed. You can do a Google search on it. There'll be over 1 million hits on this idea. And yet, as someone who has dealt with it with thousands of companies, there's no generalization of what it costs to get a new customer for a taco stand versus a financial services industry versus a car dealer. It's all different.
Mm-hmm.
And so to just accept it as a truism, this is the last thing you want to do in a time like this, is to take a generalization that applies maybe broadly to the universe. It doesn't apply to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm even willing to admit, although I don't know for sure, if you were to average together all industry and commerce, let's say in the United States,
mm-hmm.
maybe there is a 5-to-1 ratio. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. But what I'm willing to bet is that for anybody listening right now, it's not 5-to-1 for them. Averages don't necessarily mean anything.
Right.
And so to know what yours is and to be able to work with it, I just spoke to a group for you all at Eagles. I just spoke to a group of manufacturers, hundreds of them, up in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and made the point to them, if you are currently doing a significant amount of business with GM and Chrysler, new customer acquisition isn't a choice. You have no choice. So it doesn't matter what it costs to get new customers. You need new customers.
You have to, right.
It's the only common sense thing to do. And so the conventional wisdom there does not hold. So really closely examining both the conventional wisdom and using your own common sense eventually gets you to this. And really the point of the book is a simple one. Get your facts straight. Get your data in front of you. Get outside influencers, inside influencers, everybody that knows a piece of the puzzle. Bring it all together. Then rely on your intuition and your experience and your gut
mm-hmm.
to help you make decisions. What I find so often in a crisis is that leaders make decisions and then they look for the facts to back them up after they made the decision. I'm asking people to, as best they can, reverse those. Gather as much relevant data as you can in a timely fashion and make the best informed decision you can make based on both logic and experience, and then and keep your fingers crossed. whereas so often I find people just knee-jerk reaction to what feels good, and then they justify it later.
Well, I think if the president had his finger on the button, we'd all want to facts before that button is pushed. So I think the same thing is true when in business. So.
Well, you know, there's two analogies that are perhaps overused in the world of both business books and
uh-huh.
business speakers, sports analogies, and let's call them war analogies for lack of a better term. But yet, they are helpful. They are useful. And one of the things we learn from modern war is that even when we get all the relevant data, sometimes bad decisions are made.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes good decisions are made.
Mm-hmm.
But time is the thing that compresses that decision-making, and as best you can to try to get together the perspective of an outsider, to bring in outside perspective as well as internal perspective, so that you can get a more a broad overview, then that's what leads to good decision-making or the best decision-making possible. As a leader, people will reward you even if you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They will reward that you made the best decision based on the information available at the time. When you shoot from the hip, those that work with and for you can tell it, and when you're wrong then, your decision-making abilities are then suspect.
You mentioned customers a little bit ago, and on that subject, when speaking about businesses, I've heard you bring up internal versus external. In other words, the focus of why a company and their employees are there. I read a great analogy from you in an article titled, "It Ain't About the Oysters." Do you think that we tend to get caught up with the internal needs and focus of companies, and because of that, we don't attempt to understand the customer's world enough?
Well, certainly that is true with the more entrepreneurial type company
mm-hmm.
that is trying to grow at the same time they're trying to build systems to serve that outside world.
Mm-hmm.
And what ends up happening is as they grow and as they get bigger, they tend to become a heads-down organization, mired in their own internal structures that are morphing before their very eyes. And it does tend to make them too internally focused.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I deal with large publicly held companies that are tremendous at seeing the outside opportunities created by change. Their problem is the left hand doesn't always know what the right hand's doing internally.
Interesting.
There is no right or wrong between internal and external focus. It's the balance of the two that leads to sustainable, profitable growth. Finding and striking that proper balance of focus. And so, now, again, I just talked about generalizations. That is an overgeneralization. But on the whole, and in general terms, the smaller the company, the more likely they are to be too myopic internally, and they need to get their heads up and see to the opportunities happening around them. And the bigger they get, the more they're pretty good at understanding the outside world of vendors and customers and opportunity, but they can't always marshal the resources internally to meet those things. And so the balance becomes the issue.
It's hard to mention your name and not think milkshakes. Or the milkshake moment, which was the title of your last book. And this was more or less a test of the system. If a milkshake was not on the room service menu, you would order one, and hence the test. Now, with this test, it seems that you were really trying to paint a larger picture of systems and policies. And so would you kind of go on a little bit into that?
Sure. Yeah. I find, having worked with thousands of organizations over a 15-year period, that it isn't so much their strategies, their products, their opportunities. It is that they are they're too likely to shoot themselves in the foot. I call it muddled thinking, muddled management, rules, regulations. I call them stupid systems, and stupid is a harsh word. I deal with organizations who rely on their own stupid systems, and those are what ultimately are barriers to their own growth, holding them back, whether it's an accounting system, a phone system, rules, regulations, things that keep us from doing what we purport to do. We say we serve customers. We say that our organizations exist to serve our customers at the highest level, and yet I find organizations every day that are hampered by their own internal systems. However you want to define systems. Yeah, it could be a computer, but it could be an accounting form. It could be something as simple as how many packs of taco sauce you get. So, you know, it's in an attempt to standardize customers' experience, we often lose what makes us great and what makes us able to truly serve the needs of not only customers, but potential customers. And so, yeah, I'm a big believer in rules exist, and they exist for a reason. I'm a big believer that if you have a rule that says French fries are to be at a certain temperature, then that's a rule to be followed.
Right.
In other words, that exists for a reason. It's the pointless policies and the needless regulations and procedures and rules that often stifle growth in organizations, and that's what I'm usually adamant about trying to find and stamp out in any kind of organization.
What I'm hearing is balance. Balance really seems to be important, where you're saying it's important to have policies, but have balance with them. Don't you tip the scale with, go overboard.
Sure. And the ability for individuals to be able to take action and to be able to serve the needs of those that they're supposed to serve. And some people call it empowering their employees. I'm not sure where that buzzword came from. I'm often reminded of it. People say, well, you're saying to empower employees. And I'm saying, I don't think so. I'm saying that the organization should exist to serve and that everything else falls in line to help meet that goal. And so if it's empowering employees, I don't know. It's I don't see empowering employees as much as saying that everything we do is to help give our customers what they expect from us. And that's true of a nonprofit. If they have customers, they call them members, right? And so they call them donors. They have some name for them. And doctors have patients, and banks have clients. But the broad term I use is customers.
Right.
And every organization has a customer, and the organization should exist to serve. Anything that gets in the way of serving is a problem. I'm all for the types of things that will make for standardized experiences that matter. But I also think that if I have a situation where a customer is asking for a milkshake, and I have ice cream, I have milk, and I've got a blender, I I have milkshakes, right? And, even if it's not on the menu. It should be able to be done. It should not be so hard. And yet, most people find this pretty funny. I get emailed all the time with people's similar experiences. I had one just last week with the group I did for you all, and it was hilarious. He said he was in a diner, and he asked for iced tea, and they didn't have iced tea. And he said, but he saw somebody drinking hot tea. He said, well, you got tea, yeah. You have an ice machine? We sure did. Well, could you put, you give me two sugar packets and some of that tea over there, and then put some ice, and I'll make it. Yeah. And so it's just, now we can take it from food to everything.
Right.
It doesn't matter what it is. This is a simple analogy of something we've all dealt with, which is when, as a customer, we feel like we're talking to a robot.
Right.
That we become inhumane or inhuman because we're talking to somebody who isn't thinking anymore. Right. If it's not on their screen, they can't help us. If they don't know how to punch it into the point of sale system, it's impossible
doesn't
to make
exist,
it happen.
Right.
Yeah, and so that's where the systems actually undermine what it is we're trying to accomplish.
Well, what I really appreciate about you is that you're able to take something, really put some humor into it, the milkshake, while we can laugh at it. It's a serious point on the bigger scale.
Well, I appreciate that, and that's certainly what I try to do. I find that when you're talking to a group of business leaders, relevancy sometimes take a back seat to engagement, and being able to engage people with humor is a great way to help stories stick with people. And so, yeah, I try very hard to find the humor in the frustrations that we all deal with. To make it just humor, I should go do a stand-up act if I just want to do humor. What I really try to do is say I can make my points by being perhaps less dogmatic. I certainly don't want to sound preachy.
Right.
My job is to get people to remember what I'm saying on the most important issues, and humor is a better way to do that than it is. Being Mr. Know-It-All does not necessarily help people. Giving them good anecdotes to take back and use in their own workspace, that's usually what helps people the most.
I believe you had written once there was a shift in the 1980s from an industrial age to a service-based workforce, hence a plethora of changes have occurred. We no longer work the 50 years for the gold watch. As a matter of fact, it's probably more common for people to switch jobs. Do you think that there's a new shift on the way with the current economy, or has this shift already happened?
Well, I think it's true to say that we're always shifting, and I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, Peter Drucker, father of modern management, some would call him, talked about this new age that we're in the 50s and in the 60s. So it just became so obvious to us by the 80s that we all could understand what it meant to be living in an information age, in a service-based economy. Yes, I do think that we will see some fundamental shifts in the nature of what is work and why we work. And it's a 20th century industrial age concept, this idea of retirement. We've been on this planet using tools for, again, I don't want to step on anyone's religious beliefs, but anthropologists tell me that what we call Homo sapiens have been using tools with an opposable thumb for something like 200,000 years on this planet. And we never talked about retirement. You worked, and then you got sick, and then you left this earth. And I think what we're going to find is that this idea of the working to a certain age, work is what gives meaning and purpose to our lives. It was this notion for a while of a contract between me and a large employer that says if I put in 30 solid years, I get to have a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow.
Right.
And that pot of gold, of course, no longer exists because the model doesn't make sense anymore for either side of the equation. Ask GM about how that worked out for them. And so now we look at it and we say it's also not making sense because at the turn of the last century, so what I'm saying is 1900, the average male only lived to be about 49 years of age. And then women entered the workforce, and their life expectancy was a little bit more, but not much. Now we've reached the point where the average life expectancy of a newborn today is going to approach 100. Things like Social Security made sense. You weren't supposed to collect, right?
Right.
The system worked real well when you didn't collect. When everyone's collecting for long periods of time, the system doesn't work so well. And but that's okay, because what's going to happen, people are going to work well into their 80s, not because they are going to have to so much as that they're going to want to. People under the age of 50 have always had a dream for the last 100 years, and that's to retire early.
Mm-hmm.
People over the age of 70 have a nightmare, and that nightmare is called having nothing to do. People will work well into their 80s because they'll have a sense of purpose to do it. We're going to need them to do it because we're going to have a shortage in this country of skilled workers
mm-hmm.
at every level. And so we're going to need people to work longer, and people are going to want to work longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is going to be a fundamental change, and it's going to change the very nature of work. And we're still struggling with it right now, that boomers that are in leadership positions are having trouble understanding a younger generation that sees themselves as basically freelancers, that you're just renting their time and expertise for a time, and they talk about lack of loyalty, whereas I see it as young people behaving in the way the economy is incentivizing them to behave. And so we're going to have a lot of culture wars
mm-hmm.
in our workspaces. And I say workspace for a reason, at job sites, in offices,
mm-hmm.
in warehouses. There is going to be some cultural wars. They've already been fought. I think bigger ones are still to come. And it's important for both sides of that war to understand one another a little bit better, because both bring things to the table that are needed, and the other side needs to know more about it. I hear about these wars, these skirmishes right now every day,
mm-hmm.
and I tend to hear about them more from an older generation. It tends to be who's in my audience, and it tends to be, maybe it's because I'm heading that direction myself, a lot of bad-mouthing of young people. My job is to be, in my own mind, to be what I call the amiable contrarian.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as somebody says something to me that they know to be true,
right.
I ask them to question that closely held belief. And one of the most common questions I get at the end of any talk I give is, how do I deal with these young people today that don't know how to be loyal, don't know how to do what they're told, don't know how to wait their turn?
Mm-hmm.
And I push back. Rather than agree with them or tell them, give them the coping mechanisms to deal with these kids that
mm-hmm.
won't play ball the way we want them to play,
mm-hmm.
I flip it around and say, literally, you've got to understand, not them. You've
mm-hmm.
got to understand why it is they're behaving that way. They're not behaving to upset you. They are behaving in a way that makes sense to me completely, and here's why. And I go on to list it. It makes complete sense in a world where there is no loyalty on one side of the equation that they're not going to be loyal to you.
Mm-hmm.
My father worked for IBM for 30 years. It's a great job.
Mm-hmm.
He came right out of the military, went right to work for IBM. He got a beautiful handshake at the end of that arrangement. No one's going to do that for my son,
right.
who just graduates high school next week. As long as my dad didn't pull his pants down at the company picnic, he had lifetime employment, regardless of what he did.
Right.
And as a result, he got 80% of his highest year's salary for the rest of his life at the age of 56. Mm-hmm. He's 72 now and looks 62 and travels the world and has a great life. No one's going to do that for my son.
Right.
And I would encourage him to do everything he can, to have as many experiences as possible, and to take care of himself, because I'm not sure that any company is going to be taking care of him in my lifetime.
It's interesting you bring up older people understanding a younger generation. And before we began this podcast, you and I were talking about music. And the same thing is sort of true with music and the generation, sometimes that generation gap and being able to understand it. You may not like it, but it's just the fact that it is here. It is society, and you do have to face it.
Yeah, you know, there's an old expression. I know you're kind of a music fan, too. And
mm-hmm.
I worked in retail records from the time I was 13 until I was out of college. So almost 10 years of working in retail records. And there's an old expression in that business back in those days when we actually had record stores where we sold LPs.
Right.
The old expression we used to use is, the only thing that sounds worse than your older brother's records
uh-huh.
are your younger brother's records.
and
that's really still true, that
yeah.
there are generational things here at play. And yet, from a sociological standpoint, a scientific standpoint, if somebody were to look back to 100 years from now, there's no great difference between the music of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, or even today.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively the same form of music. And so, but yet we find ways to slice and dice it and make it ours. And we make this is a terrible form of music, and this is the music I love. And people are passionate about their likes and dislikes
right.
when it comes to music. This also happens in our work environments, and people have rights and wrongs and absolutes, and there's no grays. It's only black and white. It would, I think, behoove any leader today to understand that we live in a very gray world,
mm-hmm.
that there are no absolutes, only those that we construct in our own minds. To be a true leader in today's world, it's just a fact. I deal with facts every day, and the world has changed so fundamentally in such a short period of time. I try to help leaders see that and to say simple things that we knew to be true 20 or 30 years ago are no longer true. What our workforce looks like, how it thinks, how it behaves, how it is that we can get people to do what we want them to do. The rules of engagement have changed dramatically. The successful leader, the growth leader, the one that accepts those changes and looks to better understand them rather than trying to impose their own will on certain aspects. One number that jumps out at me, I just read it today, which is why it's so top of mind. I know this. In 1776, when this great nation was founded, only one city on the planet had more than 1 million people, and that was London, England. Hmm. And at that time, India was a colony. Today, there are 41 cities of 1 million or more in India alone.
Wow.
So from 1776 to now, we got one country that's got 41 cities with 1 million people. Only 12% of the world's population lived in a city of 1 million or more in 1900. Only 12%. Today it's half. But what I ask my audiences to do and what I ask your listeners to do is to try to have a 2020 vision of the year 2025. Because by 2025, two-thirds of the world will live in a city of 1 million or more. We never lived in cities. The entire human condition was not about living in cities, and now it is. And it affects who you hire, who you buy from, and who you sell to forever. It's a fundamental shift that has changed everything.
Your new book, Duck and Recover, tell me a little bit about the journey of writing this book and where the idea came from.
Well, you know, this is my third book with the good people at Wiley & Sons. And Wiley is just a great publisher in there, and they've been tremendous to work with. And they, if you took in all the textbook work and everything, they're the largest publisher in the United States. And it's great working with someone that has got the wherewithal to make good things happen. And because it's a tough time for the publishing world. Magazines, newspapers, and books are all having a tough time. But Wiley, luckily, is big enough and diversified enough to where they're weathering this storm quite nicely. They called me right after the first of the year and said, we think there needs to be a survival guide. I said, okay. My first question was, why me? There's got lots of authors. And then the second question was, are you sure a survival guide, by the time we get this thing, even if I wrote it really as quickly as I possibly could and got down what I think to be pertinent, by the time it comes out, are you sure we're still talking about survival? Or are we talking about the opportunities afforded by change? I said, as long as I can make this book about not only stopping the bleeding, but also about positioning yourself properly for the opportunities are going to be created, because they are. Opportunities are being created as we speak. So as long as it can be about the hopefulness of opportunity, then I am all for talking about duck and recover. Ducking, I don't mean to, in the terms of being defensive. It's about avoiding danger.
Right.
Positioning yourself properly. To use a sports analogy that I said are overused, but in this case, it's the only one that makes sense. In sports, everything is about getting yourself in a proper position to then unleash with explosive force when the opportunity arises. It doesn't matter if you're a martial arts expert, you're a second baseman on the crack of a bat, you're a lineman, you're pouncing off the ball. You're in the proper position to take advantage of an opportunity. That's what this book's about, is getting yourself positioned during this downturn so that when we see opportunity, we can avail ourselves of it. And that's really what the book's all about, putting yourself in the position, the duck position, so that we can recover and grow for ourselves. And once the economy starts to rise, we can rise with it.
So let's discuss logic for a second. Why is it so easy for us to see logic or lack of logic in others, but when it comes to ourselves or our own companies, it's so difficult?
Who's to say why human foibles exist? You know, the same mistakes human beings make, Shakespeare wrote about them quite eloquently, and that's why it plays well today. We know that we keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Right.
And one of the biggest mistakes that human beings make is we're really good at seeing illogical behavior in others. We're not so good at catching it in ourselves. It's even more true, perhaps, for Americans, because you know, here in the United States, two-thirds of us believe that we're above average. Two-thirds of Americans believe they're above average. Well, obviously, that's illogical.
Right.
And so we tend to, you know, this rugged individual, I'm all for it. That's what makes America great. That's what makes entrepreneurs impossible. It's what makes great companies grow. But it also can be our blind spot.
Right.
And we start to believe in ourselves. If you've had 10 years of a great run, we are less likely to question our decision-making and our logic and our use of logic when right now this is the time to really sit down and say, are we behaving logically? Have we got ourselves in the right position? It's to question your most closely held beliefs. Because what I say that is this, whatever you believe to be true, the more strongly you believe it to be true, the more likely that you need to really examine it. I'm just not sure that anything is true anymore. It's possible you could examine something and say, no, this is actually a point of difference. This is how we differentiate in the marketplace, and therefore it will always be relevant. And you've got, you've examined it, you've tried to prove it using almost a scientific method, and you've come to the conclusion that, yes, this is, we're on the right track here still. But there's other things that you may say, wow, this is what got us to this point, but it is no longer where we need to be, and we need to think about this. Whatever it is, our hiring policy, our ability to go after new business, physically, where we are, and what we do. Now is a very good time to challenge your most closely held beliefs so that you'll be positioned properly.
And not be afraid. Looking back to FDR, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. We're either our own worst enemy or we could be our own best ally.
That's exactly right. And one of my greatest concerns right now for leaders of all sorts, political, business leaders, community leaders, is that our brains are built to see pattern recognition and to find patterns in things that maybe even if they don't exist. And so many of us are relying on patterns that did exist for a while have changed. You know, our financial service industry has changed forever. And I don't know where it's going, but I know it will not look like what it once looked like. And so for so many of us that have dealt with certain givens, it's a hard thing to get your head around. Literally, I every day I get up and say, well, my rule of thumb on that for years has been this, but is that rule of thumb true? Somebody the other day said, I used the term rule of thumb. He said, you know, at some point when you have your hands filled with all rules of thumb, you're all thumbs. You know, and that I find that that's one of the barriers to growth for a lot of leaders. It isn't that they don't know enough. It's that they know too much. They know so much about what it takes to be successful in their company and in their industry and in their communities that they lose sight of the obvious. They lose sight of big ideas and big things, big opportunities, because they're mired in the details of knowing too much.
So let me bring up a couple phrases from your book, and maybe you can expand on them. One is, overcompensation is your enemy.
Yeah. Right now, what so many business leaders do is when in a crisis, something that perhaps should have been noticed a couple of years ago has now reached literally the level of crisis, right? They're in crisis mode. And in order to combat it, they overcompensate. So the analogy I would use is somebody that knows how to steer a boat. As I'm talking to you, I'm looking out my window, and I'm looking at a channel on the Inner Harbor here in North Carolina. And somebody that knows how to steer a boat understands that a slight turn can help you guide the boat to go straight. Small, incremental compensations with a little bit of delay in the system. In other words, you turn and you wait for a moment to see what the actual result is, and then you compensate back and forth. What happens in a crisis is that you wildly swing. Somebody who's inexperienced does S-turns down the channel in a crisis, be it a storm or whatever it is. If they start heading for the shore, they overcompensate. Now they're heading for the bank, and, and the S-turn all the way down. Businesses behave this way in a crisis often because they are overcompensating. Maybe they should have been watching their cash flow better, and now they realize they're at a cash crunch. And rather than slowly but surely easing into a new policy on, say, collections, they overcompensate and cut everybody off. They cut their nose to spite their face. They alienate the customer that they've trained for years that it's okay to pay in 45 days instead of 30 days.
Right.
And now they've been cut off and you lost a customer, and it's the worst possible solution. So that's when overcompensation, things like that, what instead of saying, we need to really think about our sales and marketing budget, they cut completely their sales, fire all the salespeople and cut all, every advertisement, you know, and that's called overcompensation. It's to be avoided.
Status quo is an equal foe, like the rhyme, by the way.
Well, you know, it would seem like overcompensating would be the opposite of the status quo and keeping to the status quo, but really they're born of the same problems, illogical thinking. And so what happens is when you're in a crisis, people respond in a couple of ways. They tend to overcompensate, or they do nothing. whether it's analysis paralysis or sticking their heads in the sand, trying to pretend like the troubles and challenges are not really there. They stick with the status quo, and status quo is the opposite of grow. It does not lead to growth. And so one of the most common things I hear right now from business leaders is, and I've even heard a few politicians use this lately, they say, we refuse to participate in this recession. And they think it's quite clever. And, you know, once you've heard something a lot, they think they've said it for the first time. And, you know, after I heard it for the 100th time, I thought about it for a moment. I don't think that's the right attitude, because that says we're just going to keep doing what we've always done. And it does not acknowledge that the outside world has changed dramatically. And so to say you're not participating means you're not going to look for the opportunities afforded by change. And so now we may be somewhat parsing words, and this may be a semantic argument more than a real one, but I think it's indicative. I think it's important to say we are in challenging economic times. For me, the most challenging economic times of my career. And to ignore it or pretend like it's not happening, which is what I hear, to ignore it and to say we're not going to participate, I'm just the opposite. Where are the opportunities that are being created because of this downturn in the economy, and how can we take advantage of it? That's participating in the recession in a positive way that leads to growth.
In your book, and I love this, you talk about triage categories. If you're at a disaster site, you define different triage categories, and you kind of make the correlation between disaster sites and businesses and like the economy that we're experiencing now. You have laid it out as immediate, delayed, minimal, and expectant. Can you explain these categories and what they mean for businesses?
Well, I think that perhaps even more important than the categories themselves is the basic human trend. It happens on the battlefield. It happens at disaster sites. And it happens to businesses in crisis. It is human nature that we tend to over-triage, not under-triage, meaning if someone is the walking wounded, it's human nature to maybe take them up a level and to say, no, they actually need immediate attention, whereas perhaps they could wait. So it's human nature in business right now, too, to when you have new experiences that they tend to get our attention. Hemorrhaging is ugly. If you've never seen someone profusely bleeding, it can be arresting, even for a well-trained person. Same thing happens in business. When you're in a business that is hemorrhaging for some reason, you know, you and I both know head wounds tend to bleed a lot, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to die, right? But it's so visually arresting. And so when we're looking at balance sheets and profit and loss statements that look scary, we have to really ask ourselves, is it something we need to apply a tourniquet to? Or is it something that just looks ugly?
That brings you to a quote that I'd really like to read from your book, and I think it's a great quote. It says, we all have a tendency to over-prioritize problems that are unique in our experience. Whatever the crisis du jour is, be sure that you are able to frame it properly. Is it really the most important thing for you to address today, or is it simply the most unsettling issue you've dealt with recently?
The most unsettling issue you've dealt with recently is interesting. One of the examples I use is, I have clients that I work with and businesses that I know where a collection person calling them on a regular basis and threatening to seize assets and sending very nasty letters from attorneys, that's just their standard operating procedure. That's just how they do business. I don't know how they do it that way. I wouldn't want to do it that way. But there are people who operate that way. If that's never happened to you, if you've never had a threatening call from an attorney or a collection agency that says they're putting a lien on this and they're going to the courthouse to do that, it could mean that you over-prioritize it. It becomes a gigantic crisis in your mind. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And maybe it's an idle threat. Maybe it's just unique in your experience. You've never had someone threaten to take your firstborn away from you, you know, for your bills. And so you over-prioritize it. It takes clarity, and it takes a little bit of stepping back and saying, is this the most important thing for me to do today? Or is there something actually that's really a crisis, and this is just a lot of noise?
When the media puts out stories about companies, some of it, some justified, some not, it can cause the public to feel unsettled. And Do you think that are some companies forced to face certain issues that may not be the most important, but issues that get the most press?
Yeah, you know, I'm a student of media. I studied it as a college student, and I'm a big believer that the media reflects who we are. It doesn't tell us what to think. Mm-hmm. It tends to tell us what we want to know more about, because it's a for-profit thing. Mm-hmm. I'm told every day that the media is partly to blame for the downturn in the economy. You know, I tend to think that they're telling us what we want to hear, and that might be a bad thing, too. Maybe we should be careful what we wish for.
Right.
But when it comes to the media, yeah, they overplay certain things. So when it comes to the popular press, as it relates to what's happening with our economy, there is one very hopeful number that I share with people every day. Regardless of how it happened, why it happened, or what the ramifications are, in October, 9% of the U.S. population said that the country was headed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So the number that we've been tracking for 50 years. Is the country headed in the right direction? And 9% of the population thought so. Today, it's right around 50%. That's good for the economy. That's good for capitalism. Now, what are the ramifications, and what will be the push-me-pull-you effect of how that's been created? I'm not a prognosticator on such matters. I'm not an economist. Mm-hmm. I just know it's good for the economy, and people think the country's headed in the right direction. And as a political agnostic and a business realist, that's a good thing for us. And I'm not sure that's been reported enough. Mm-hmm. That's a dramatic swing in a very short period of time. What's ever led to it, it's allowed us to at least fight another day. The idea that the press and the media are reporting too much about the downturn or about a recession and using the word, I don't know. I don't know what you can do when the nation's largest financial institutions are brought to their knees from undercapitalization, and the government is, and my money is going into it. You can't not report on it.
Right.
And there has to be a reason. Again, I'm an amiable contrarian. I'm a pretty nice guy. But every day I'm told that the media is partly to blame, and I'm not so sure. I would rather concentrate on all the other actors involved in what has created our financial crisis. I think the media has been pretty responsible in just reporting what's happening.
On one hand, we can say that this kind of media coverage might be in a small percentage of companies. But on the other hand, these larger companies who are under the microscope, they tend to set a protocol for others to follow.
Yeah.
What should companies do, maybe smaller companies? Do they beat to their own drum, or how do they handle protocols that the larger companies that are setting?
Well, I think that it's one of the beautiful things about being a business owner or even an entrepreneurial spirit within a larger organization is that it is your default setting to zig when others are zagging. Hmm. And to have it in your own makeup, in the way that you're built, and the way you see the world is always full of possibilities and opportunities. And you're able to, when everyone else is seeing nothing but closing up doors, you're seeing the ones that open. And so it's normally not a problem. It's been my experience so far. Now, this is my fourth downturn as an adult. I am always struck by the resiliency of certain types of growth leaders, regardless of size or type or industry. And so they don't have to be told that they need to look at it objectively and with their own set of criteria and their own ideas. They do it naturally, whether they're told to do it or not. So I don't worry about those that are able to do that. There are always going to be plenty of them. The ones I'm concerned about are those that have become somewhat complacent because maybe they've had good times.
Mm-hmm.
They've had a good run. Fear is a motivator to an extent, not the type that makes you seize up, but to always be a little bit paranoid is what leads to great things. Organizations that grow are always hearing footsteps behind them and always concerned about who might be catching up, and they attempt to differentiate on always being one step ahead of current competitors, and maybe even making themselves stay ahead of would-be competitors that say, no, we can't enter that space because these folks are doing it too well. And what's beautiful about things today is that it's so widespread in terms of not only who's doing it, but geographically, there's no bent to it. It's all over this country. You know, in the last 10 years, I've had the great fortune to travel outside the U.S. quite a bit to speak. I've even done that on Eagle's behalf on a number mm-hmm. of occasions. One of the things I'm struck by is, regardless of how they feel about the United States politically, and where we stand in their minds, wherever I go in the world, the one thing you can know for sure is they admire our entrepreneurial spirit. It doesn't matter where I go, what they think about us, we are the world authority on entrepreneurial thinking and behavior, and everyone wishes that they had, I don't know if we're born with it, some people make that suggestion. If we learn it in our culture, others point to that. I think it's a combination. I think that we have a genetic marker somewhere in us that says that this country was founded by a whole bunch of people that took a huge risk at one point, got on a boat with nothing and came over, and from all over the world. And so that is still the way that America is evolving. And so we come at it, I think, with a certain type of personality. At the same time, success tends to reinforce itself. And so a system that helps foster that entrepreneurial endeavor, it becomes a reinforcing loop, just keeps reinforcing itself, and the world recognizes that, and therefore the American dream is still alive and well. We should not look at this crisis of confidence as being anything more than a momentary blip in what has been the greatest wealth creation in the history of mankind. And as I said at the beginning, wealth creation isn't the sense of purpose. It's a great way to keep score. And we keep score on our businesses and on our country with things having to do with economic development, and we are particularly good at it and have been for a really long time. And I don't think that this particular moment in time will end up being the end of that. We still have a long way to run with the American dream.
My guest has been Stephen S. Little, author and speaker, and he has written a new book, Duck and Recover: The Embattled Business Owner's Guide to Survival and Growth. It will be released in stores in June. Stephen, thank you so much for being a guest on our show, and extremely glad to have you on.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
If you're interested in acquiring more information on Stephen S. Little for your next event, contact Eagles Talent Connection online at www.eaglestalent.com or call us at 1-800-345-5607. My name is Sheldon Senek, and I've been your host for the Eagles Talent Connection podcast. If you'd like to leave any comments about the podcast, you can do so on our blog, and you can get to our blog two ways. Either visit us online at www.eaglestalent.com, or our direct blog address is www.speakersbureaublog.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and remember, keep America beating. This has been an Eagles Talent Connection production.